You're listening to Against the Grain. This is Sasha Lilly. The historian and teacher Howard Zinn influenced generations of Americans with both his activism and writings, especially his best-selling book, A People's History of the United States, which was published in 1980. That work of history from below conveyed his deeply held belief that the many actions of unnamed people have shaped the course of world events in profound and countless ways. As the outpouring of grief following his death attests, Zinn played a crucial role on the American left, and one which will be hard to fill. I had the tremendous fortune to sit down for almost an hour and a half with Howard Zinn in his living room in Auburndale, Massachusetts, on November 5th, 2 months before his death. We spoke about his life and times, his historiography and political philosophy, his thoughts about writing and art, and his vision for a just society. He was charming, witty, and optimistic as ever. Today and tomorrow, we'll be playing that interview in its entirety. Let's go now to part one of my conversation with Howard Zinn. I wonder if I could start by asking you how your own personal background has shaped your politics.
Well, I think with everybody, it's always a very difficult thing to trace your personal background and see how it's affected politics. Because, you know what I find? I find that very often are people who seem to have similar personal backgrounds and different politics. And yet, obviously, there must be a connection. In my case, I think it's the fact that I grew up in a working-class family, a struggling family. My father was a waiter. He met my mother when they were both immigrants, factory workers in New York, and I grew up in tenements and miserable places. And one step ahead of the landlord in the Depression years. And so, you know, home was not a nice place to be. I remember the first time I walked into somebody's home who had a piano and house looked clean and neat. I thought, wow, this is very nice. I'd never saw anything like this. No, home was no place to be. It crowded and messy, and so we lived out on the street, really. I mean, that's, you know, in poor neighborhoods, that's what you have. You have street life. Kids are out on the street. That's where they have their fun. That's where they meet their friends. And that's why when you walk out here in the suburbs and in middle-class neighborhoods, you don't see anybody on the street. They have nice homes. I suppose that. Growing up in the Depression years, seeing people having a hard, hard time, seeing people evicted from their homes. I have a vivid memory of seeing furniture piled up on the sidewalk outside of this family home, and a crowd gathering, and then the crowd facing off the police and moving the furniture back into the house, a very dramatic conflict. But this was the kind of scene that I thought you don't forget. So you might say I was class conscious at an early age, without ever hearing the word class. At the age of 18, instead of going to college, I went into work in a shipyard in Brooklyn Navy Yard. The kids in my neighborhood never went to college. They graduated from high school, or they dropped out of high school, and they went to work. Families needed the money, and families couldn't afford to send them to college, even though it was a free college, even though it was city college, you know. No, they needed their kids' little salaries. And so I went to work in the Brooklyn Navy Yard for $14.40 a week and worked there for 3 years. But in the meantime, I had become politically interested, involved, radicalized, I think, by encountering young radicals on my street, and communists and members of the Young Communist League, and they were very political and very smart. They knew all about what was going on in Mexico. I was impressed by how much they knew. And I was interested in these things, but I didn't know as much as they did. I was reading books. I read at an early age. I think this is one of the important influences in my life, just starting to read at an early age, starting to read Dickens and Mark Twain when I was 13 or 14. You know, my parents didn't know about books. There was no book in the house, not a single book in the house. No movie magazines my mother read, but no books. But I picked up books on the street, you know, and read. So I was interested. I was reading about fascism and socialism, and so, yes, by the time I went to the Navy Yard to work, I was already a political person. Well, in fact, just before that, I'd been in a demonstration in Times Square, which my communist friends took me to, my first demonstration. And it was exciting. I didn't know what a demonstration was. I thought going to Times Square would be fun. And so there were all these people milling around in Times Square, and at a certain moment, they unfurled banners. And to this day, I don't even know what the banners said. Probably stop fascism, stop war, something like that. Sounded okay to me. And then I heard sirens. I thought, there must be a fire somewhere. No, of course not. The police attacking the crowd. And this was an important revelation to me. My God, police attacking these people, they're not doing anything, just marching and holding placards. Before I knew it, I was spun around, knocked on the head, knocked unconscious, actually. Woke up in a doorway, who knows when, an hour later? Times Square was as it had been before. Nobody quiet, no demonstration. No, it was eerie. But it was a radicalizing moment for me. I thought, wow, these guys, these radicals, they're right. You know, the state is not neutral. The police are not neutral. There is no real free speech in America, not if you antagonize the establishment. Anyway, so I guess what I'm saying is that even before I went to work in a shipyard at the age of 18, I was already politicized in a certain way. And then in the shipyard in Brooklyn Navy Yard, I encountered three other young fellows who were also young radicals, and four of us set out to organize the young workers in the shipyard. And we did. We formed, because we were excluded from the union. The union was an AFL union, craft union. They only took in skilled workers, which meant that they were excluding blacks, because the black workers in the Navy Yard were the unskilled workers, but the heaviest work, riveters and chippers and, you know, nasty work. So the young apprentices were outside the union. We organized them. And meanwhile, the war in Europe was going on. And soon the United States was in the war. And then my friends outside of the Navy Yard were going into the military. And because if you were in the Navy Yard, you didn't have to go in the military. You were doing important war work, you know, building ships. I worked on the USS Iowa and the USS Missouri. And Missouri was later became famous because that's where the Japanese surrender was signed and so on. Yeah, so we were doing important work. But I didn't want to stay in the Navy Yard. I wanted to get into the fray. You know, fascism. I almost said fascism beckoned. No. But the war against fascism beckoned. And then some of my friends were already in the military. And so, yeah, so I enlisted in the Air Force. And
how did that experience shape your political outlook?
Well, that's an interesting question of how the war itself shaped my political outlook, because I entered the war, entered the Air Force as an enthusiastic bombardier. That's why I became a bombardier on a heavy bomber stationed in England and flying missions over Germany and Hungary and Czechoslovakia and even France. And it was a good war. That's why I enlisted. War against fascism. It was very clear they were the bad guys. We were the good guys. But I began to have doubts, small doubts. Doubts first put into my head by a guy who was on another crew. Young fellow who was, he was a gunner on another crew, and we became friends. I guess we became friends because we were both readers. There weren't too many readers in the Air Force. And so we exchanged books and ideas and talked. And once he said to me, said, you know, we are fighting in an imperialist war. I was startled. I was, what do you mean? He said, both sides are imperialist. Fascists are terrible. Now, what about our side? You know, the British Empire, the French Empire, the Dutch Empire, the American Empire, the Soviet Union, Stalin. Well, you know, what makes us think we're the good guys? No, that both sides are fighting for imperial interests. It was shocking to me to hear that. I was so totally imbued with the idea we're on the right side. I mean, to this day, of course, I understand how soldiers make a decision at the beginning. I'm on the right side. Once you make that decision, you don't have to think anymore. You don't have to examine what you do from that point on. Everything you do is right. You can kill. You can drop bombs on Hiroshima. And you're on the right side. So I listened to this guy, and I said, well, if that you believe that, why are you here? He said, well, I'm here to talk to guys like you. This startled me, too, the idea that, wow, this guy's risking his life, you know, to be, you might say, to embed himself in the military and to speak out against the war in which he's risking his life. Ironically, well, tragically, this guy didn't return from a mission some weeks later. You know, amazing. He gave me a book called The Yogi and the Commissar by Arthur Koestler. Mm. Not a book that's not well known these days, but Koestler.
Author of The God That Failed.
The author, yeah. He was in The God That Failed. So a lot of people know that, but they don't know The Yogi and the Commissar. But Koestler had fought in Spain. He had the credentials of a left-winger, so I could listen to him. And he was anti-Soviet, critical of the Soviet Union. And The Yogi and the Commissar. And he was it started me, I think, on the road to examining the war I was in. But I didn't do that until after the war. After the war, I picked up John Hershey's book on Hiroshima. And I had seen the headlines of the bombing of Hiroshima when I had flown from Europe back to the United States with my crew. And we were having a 30-day furlough before going on to the Pacific. And we were going to continue bombing missions in the Pacific. And I had been married just before I went overseas. And my wife and I were going to spend this 30-day furlough out in the country and stopped at a bus stop. And there was this newspaper with this headline, Atomic Bomb Dropped on Hiroshima. We were glad. Wow, this is great. What's the atomic bomb? We didn't know. Just another bomb. I had been dropping bombs. Maybe this is a bigger bomb, but it sounds like this might end the war, so this is good, you know. That was my attitude at the moment. And then I read John Hersey's book about Hiroshima. And then it came home to me what that was. You know, he interviewed the survivors in Hiroshima. You can imagine what the survivors looked like. The people without eyes, without faces, without legs, without arms. I mean, and the reality of bombing suddenly came home to me, and I was horrified because I had been bombing. I had never seen anybody down below. I didn't know what was happening to people under my bombs. Because you fly from 30,000 feet high, you don't see any human beings. It's a mechanical, distant operation, which is what so much of modern warfare is like. People killing at a distance, people killing non-human objects, you know. And so I began to think about that. And then began to think about Dresden and the bombing we had done in Europe. It wasn't until actually years later that I learned about the bombing of Tokyo. I think to this day most Americans do not know that several months before Hiroshima, we firebombed Tokyo and killed 100,000 people in one night. So all of these experiences made me reconsider the idea of the good war. Is there such a thing as a good war? If World War II, which was the best of wars, the most clear-cut moral war, fascism, and so on, if this, the most clear-cut moral war, needed to be examined, then surely all the other wars. So that experience turned me against war, period. After I came back from the Air Force and my wife and I lived in a little rat-infested apartment in Brooklyn. I hope, you know, people in Brooklyn won't take offense at this. But, there are rat-infested apartments in every big city. This happened to be in Brooklyn. And it's interesting how you leave the military and you go back to your life before. And if your life before was in the working class, even though you've been in the military and you've been an officer and you've worn good uniforms and eaten good food, you're, as they say, an officer and a gentleman. And then the war ends and you're back in the working class, working at odd jobs, which is what I was doing. You know, I went back to the Navy Yard for a while, didn't like it, worked as a ditch digger, worked as a waiter, worked as this, worked as that, you know. And that was my life, my back to my working class life. Decided to go to college under the GI Bill. So I went to college under the GI Bill. I went to college in the daytime and worked 4 to 12 shift in a warehouse loading trucks because... Well, the GI Bill was wonderful and generous, you might say. It still wasn't enough to keep you alive. So I had to work, and my wife had to work, and we had two little kids, and they were in a nursery and so on. So I went to Columbia Graduate School, got a PhD at Columbia, and then my first teaching job was at Spelman College in Atlanta. And the next 7 years were in the South and living in the black community of Atlanta, 1956 to 1963.
Which was when the civil rights movement was starting to take off.
Those were very important years. Of course, I had no idea when I went down there what it would be like. I was just looking for a job. It wasn't that. I was looking for teaching a black college, you know. I just looking for a job, and this job came along. Oh, a Negro college, never heard of it, you know, but a job. So we packed up our old Chevy and went down, and that was probably the most educational experience of my life.